Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to learn about new dietary approaches against Alzheimer's, how vitamin D can support weight loss, how elderberry eases inflammation, and how gardening therapy helps women on long-term sick leave return to work. Plus, we're going to have a guest in the second part of our program today, Stuart Wexler. He's regarded as one of the nation's top researchers and investigators into domestic terrorism in the United States and radical religion and its activities. Hence, we're going to talk about domestic religious terrorism in the United States, the other jihadi movement within extreme Christian right that nobody dares talk about. Well, we dare. We will. Also, we're going to look at global trade is collapsing as the worldwide economic recession deepens. And I found an interesting piece, liking to be ahead of the curve on information to you. This is from Adam Taggart from Peak Prosperity, and he's saying, hold on a second, I'm out here in Silicon Valley, I have a Silicon company, it's all a bubble, and it's collapsing. A lot of engineers are being laid off. Wow, okay, no one else is talking about that. And the American Cancer Society does something extremely different. It tells people maybe you need fewer mammograms. From Denise Grady of the New York Times, I'll share insights on that. And baby boomers are feeling squeezed by the rise in rents. So guess what? A lot of them are moving back into their homes of their kids. Well, how does that feel? Well, I guess if you graduated from college and you didn't have a job, or you had a job or two that wasn't making enough to pay for rent, and you had to live in the basement or attic of your parents' home, well, then you know how it feels. It works both ways. So we have a lot to share. Also, yesterday, the head of the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, said that Hitler was motivated by a Palestinian when it came to the Holocaust, creating the Holocaust against Jews. This has gotten a strong response. A lot of historians, including Jewish historians, saying it's simply not true. Holocaust was being manifest long before that single meeting they ever had in 1941. However, what we're going to do is we're going to play you an audio clip today. And all the people you're hearing on the audio clip, I believe, are Jewish historians, scholars, giving you the true history of the creation of the Israeli state in Palestine. And also we're going to talk about it's the occupation that is creating a lot of conflict. So as you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. From Tufts University, a good study talking about dietary approaches and what they're calling the DASH, D-A-S-H, eating plan, and helping your brain. Now, the DASH is really it's a hybrid dietary plan. It combines the best for your cognitive health. It's pretty much the Mediterranean diet. It is specific for brain health. How so? Well, because, quote, from the study, inflammation and oxidative stress play a large role in the development and progression of Alzheimer's disease. And the diet, particularly emphasizing foods such as green leafy vegetables, berries, olive oil, which are rich in antioxidants and anti-inflammatory agents that may help to protect against dementia and cognitive decline. And so it goes on to talk about how this was really good. And it was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Alzheimer and Dementia. Now, because I have spent my entire adult life as a clinical nutritionist, as a registered dietitian, as a PhD with honors in human nutrition and public health science, and as a scientist in anti-aging medicine, I've looked at everything that I could think of that could impact your brain. And early on, I saw that in cultures where they, around the world, including in Georgia, which at that time was part of the Soviet satellite countries, and in South America, especially up in the Andes, in the on the island of Crete, and also on the island of Okinawa, those were the places around the world that had the longest-lived, healthiest people I could find. Also in Hunza, which is in the Himalayas between China and India. So anyhow, what it means is this. The more soft drinks, sugar, artificial sweeteners, alcohol in any quantity, the more fried foods, the more stress, the more pollution in the air around you, the more sedentary you are, and the more electrical appliances you're around, or electromagnetic appliances like computers, cell phones, the more you create oxidative stress in the brain. That in turn creates a series of chemicals like cytokines. Those attack your brain cells, your neurons, and they denature them or adversely affect them, alter them or kill them or damage them. When you're young, the body still has a lot more brain cells, so you won't notice it. As you get older, after the age of 27, you're really aging, then you begin to notice you won't remember things quite as quickly. Some names won't be as they were before, right at the tip of your tongue. Dates, places, things you've read will kind of skip your mind. That's because you're destroying more cells, and you're not laying down new ones, nor are you repairing old ones. So we only got one of three things we can do here. So let's just make it real simple. One, prevent the damage in the first place. Now, what is the likelihood that the average American will change everything that's wrong in their life? How about zero? Two, you'll change some of the things you're doing because you've been forced to. A physician says, look, you've had a heart attack, or you got cancer or emphysema, you know, you've got to give up this, that, or the other. And you may indeed give that up, as people will. That doesn't reverse your aging, nor does it stop the diseases that will manifest later in life. It merely gives you less damage that will quicken the disease process. So you're still going to get cancer or a stroke or heart disease or arthritis. You've just given yourself a little more breathing room, and that can give a false sense of security. For example, when I recently counseled just last week, a woman who said, I don't know why I have cancer. I haven't smoked in 20 years. Was because you smoked that you end up with lung cancer. And the fact that you haven't smoked doesn't mean that you went in there and completely detoxified your body, rejuvenated your cells. No, I didn't do any of that. I didn't know I had to. My doctor didn't tell me to do that. If I would have known that when I stopped smoking, I had to repair damage and how to do it, I would have done it. Okay. Well, now I'm trying to help this person do all that. It's just that it's a lot easier before the cancer manifests than afterwards, but it can still work. So how much are we willing to change? Well, the average person wants change. They just don't want to be the person that changes, and not that radically. We have a real problem in America by change that makes us feel uncomfortable, or we have to stop things we're used to or adapt to. And thirdly is we make completely radical changes. We go full on, give it our all. And that's when you see remarkable changes. Remarkable. I'm working now with a person who had end-stage multiple sclerosis, should be dead, and instead is beginning the process of walking again. I'm not aware of any other case this advanced as this ever occurred. And we're working on a regular weekly basis because this person doesn't live nearby. But they had enough improvement in just 2 weeks that they committed themselves 100% to change. Whether they stick with that or not is never the matter. My hope is they do. So when you start to do just a diet, and this study is showing this, if you just did a healthy diet, a plant-based diet, and you or limited your animal and intake and high saturated fats from arachidonic acid foods, and if you start to eat more berries, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, pomegranates, if you had more green leafy vegetables like kale, a collard greens, arugula, watercress, all those are terrific for you. You can start to turn off inflammation in your brain and postpone dementia and hence Alzheimer's by a good margin. So that's what it is. So when people say, well, there's nothing you can do, they're wrong. There's a lot you can do. And even if you just shifted towards a plant-based diet, that's a lot of good. You're doing yourself a big favor. And let's say you got a mother and father, and they're the ones who have got the problem, not you. And they don't want to change anything. I had this happen recently. Well, okay. Then try to work in a little more creative way. Take all the nutrients they need, things like ginkgo biloba and vitamin D and phosphatidylserine and acetyl-L-choline and choline and inositol and B-complex and B12 and folic acid and glycerol phosphorylcholine and L-carnosine and coenzyme Q10 and magnesium and calcium and vitamin C and quercetin at high doses, and you put all that into a drink, their favorite flavor as a smoothie, and then give them lots of quality branched amino acids for protein, from plant-based protein, split pea, brown rice, a hemp, all those proteins are good, and have them sip that throughout the day. So if you gave them all those, they're not going to take them. But if you had them given to them in a drink, they will. Even in an assisted living center, even in a nursing center. If you give a prepared drink, they're not going to do it. But if you did it, that can help them. And load it up with berry concentrates. Give them as much of the berries as possible. Berries for the brain. Just remember that. Berries for your brain. That can make a difference. All right? Now, vitamin D, according to this newest study, can help you with weight loss, and that's important. Quote from the study, over 60% of Americans are overweight or obese. Given that obesity is linked to multiple health risks, and cancer, heart disease, diabetes, something needs to change. Well, according to the European Congress on Obesity, one way that you can help is by getting vitamin D, because it can help the body and get your blood sugar or blood levels up. And they did a study of vitamin D for women as compared to a placebo, and there was a big difference. The women were able to lose weight in these 400 women. They were taking 25,000 international units of vitamin D a day versus a placebo. Big difference, irrespective of the calorie intake. And it also turns off inflammation and the breakdown of fat. So, most people are vitamin D deficient, so make sure you're getting, especially in the wintertime, when you're not out in the sun, get at least 3,000 to 4,000 units of vitamin D a day. Now, from the University of Connecticut, elderberry, and by the way, elderberry is just a superstar. I don't think more than a handful of Americans probably used elderberry in the last 50 years. But it used to be the drink. When I was a young baby and kid, that my mother gave us every day, she gave us cod liver oil every day and elderberry. And she blended the two together so that we wouldn't throw up the cod liver oil, which tasted terrible. In any case, everyone where I grew up used elderberry. Everybody. Because they knew it was good for you. Well, here's the latest from the University of Connecticut. Elderberry extract can address obesity and metabolic-related inflammation in this study, and it turns off inflammation. Well, let's just see what's connected with inflammation, which is bad. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, macular degeneration, heart disease, diabetes, cancers, fibromyalgia, osteoporosis, all your itises, ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, all of those are associated with inflammation. So your teaspoon of elderberry extract every day in the morning can help turn off that inflammation. And it's great to help prevent colds and flu. And finally, gardening therapy helps women on long-term sick leave return to work, from University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Quote, being and working in a garden combined with active job coaching can effectively help women on long-term sick leave return to work. Women are statistically overrepresented as being at risk of becoming chronically ill and on sick leave. In addition to the economic burden on society, long-term sick leave has significant negative consequences on women themselves, both health-wise and economically. And then it goes into each one of these and why it's important to garden. Well, let me share a few. I think everybody should do gardening. I love gardening. I did a film on gardening. It's called How to Garden Organically. And it's free. It's up on, if you go to Gary Nall YouTube television, I put up 100 short videos up there just last week. I have 400 more I'm putting up. I'm putting up 500. These are not the full-length award-winning documentaries. These are little video pieces to show you how to do things like how to garden, how to prune, how to plant, how to fertilize. And just getting your hands in the soil, being able to be out with nature, it's all good. So if you don't have a backyard you can do this in, can you do it on a roof? Can you do it in a community garden? Can you do it with other people? You can do a completely passive hoop greenhouse that relies just upon the sun. And you can do that and grow a lot of vegetables and fruits, microgreens, and sprouts. And that's easy to do. If you have no room and just have an apartment, which is fine, then you can do it on your countertop. Yeah. And watch the film. There's a four-part series called The Art of Healthy Living. And part of The Art of Healthy Living is gardening. And I show you how to do it. But in any case, just watching something grow from the time you prepare your soil and you plant your seed and you see it germinating, that little tiny green sprout coming up, and then you nurture it, you give it water, and then light, and you green it out with photosynthesis by putting it where it can get sun through a window or outside. And then if it's a sprout, 5-7 days later, you're eating it. It's in a salad. And microgreens is about 20 days, but you're eating microgreens, extraordinarily rich in enzymes. They're living foods, chlorophyll, and over 500 different phytonutrients, natural chemicals inside those little micro sprouts. You're now consuming, and your body is thanking you for that. So that helps people feel good. That helps their immune system, because when you're feeling good and you're happy, your immune system is feeling better and happier, and you get back to work and you overcome illnesses that otherwise would be lingering if you feel depressed and sad. Gardening is just one way. Now, how about putting on some wonderful music while you're gardening? Now you're adding two positive stimulations. And while you're gardening, why not just think wonderful thoughts? Mindful meditation, just positive thoughts. Don't allow any of those negative thoughts in your brain. Three things happening all at once. That is a wonderful way to spend a half hour or an hour every day. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. A couple of things I want to share before we take a break. And the first up is baby boomers, my generation, feeling squeezed by the rise in rents. This is from MarketWatch, from Amy Hoke, and it says, quote, will high rents force boomers, meaning 45 years or 45 to 69, to move in with their kids? Quote, rising rents have been cited as a reason millennials aren't moving out of their parents' basements, but higher rents could force some boomers to move in with their children. So says the president of the Real Property Management Franchise, the average rent for a three-bedroom single-family home in the United States is $1,363, and that's an increase. Workers 55 and over, on average, saved $150,300 for retirement. That's good. But then you have to realize you have to withdraw 5% of that from your savings every year just to pay for the additional rent if you, and that's bad, which means that the average person retiring today who's worked a noble life, that person will not be able to pay their rent from their pensions. It's just not going to cut it. So you got to have another job even after you're retired, and or the rents have to come down. But the market is being driven, so no one's going to lower the rent. So if people are not lowering the rent because of greed, and the hedge funds have bought up all those foreclosed homes and are now renting them out, but they're terrible landlords. You have a problem, and if you have one of those the hedge fund or equity partnership-owned houses, what's the likelihood if the plumbing breaks, there's a problem, they're going to come and fix it? Well, ask any of the people who are now complaining that roofs are leaking and toilets are not working. And this is the responsibility of the landlord. No, these people are only landlords in name only to make money. So I believe that what we have to do is start looking at the next stage in reality for the average American, and that is shared living. What do I mean? I mean, get a group of people together that you have some things in common, and then find out what each person's living requirements are, and then find a place where it's large enough that each person has their own private, you know, living quarters, but you have things you share, like you share a dining room. I had a group that approached me 2 years ago. There were 55 of them, and I met with them at my home in Florida, and I gave them suggestions. There were some that were young with kids and some that were older and retired, and I asked a basic question. I said, if you're old and retired, how are you going to feel being around kids who are going to be kids? They're going to be doing what kids normally and should do, running, yelling, screaming, fighting, making a mess. Well, that's not for us. I said, well, then you should only be with people who have common interests. And the other young people, you know, like one person said, well, she doesn't mind, you know, sharing a place with kids. Fine. You know, and then they were able to simply get some of their common desires and needs. And then one person says, well, I'm very finicky about my food. I heard about you. I haven't heard you on the radio, but I heard from my sister who listens to you every day, lives in Brooklyn, who's a police officer, that that you're a fanatic about cleanliness and you don't allow anyone to touch your food. And I'm kind of like that, but possibly for different reasons. And I said, look, you are right. I don't allow anyone to touch my food unless it's cooked, because I don't know where their hands have been. I don't want what's in their body in mine. It's that simple. If we lived in a society where people were hygienically conscious, that's one thing, but we don't. So here's what you do. Make room for another refrigerator. One's yours, one's theirs. Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Have your own cookware. Buy quality stainless steel cookware. Buy quality glass and for your dining. So you have your own dishes. You have your own appliance. And that way, you don't have to worry about that. And there's room in a kitchen to do it. You don't have to have a huge refrigerator. So I believe that for a lot of people, finding places to share. And then if you have a nice enough estate that you could rent, you could have backyards and you could do gardening. You could work together to build, you know, like a koi pond or a swan pond. Waterfalls. There's all kinds of wonderful things you can do that are not expensive. You can do them yourself. In fact, I show people how to make their own koi pond, koi, which is a beautiful Japanese fish. And they're very friendly. I could pet my koi, hand feed them. And if I got a company to come and do it, they're going to charge you a huge amount of money. Do it yourself. It's very simple, easy, inexpensive. But you can share that environment. You can share those responsibilities. So shared living, I believe, is the future, and I'm going to be doing a whole 8-hour workshop on that in the coming months, because I believe it's time for people to who are frustrated by not being able to afford where they live, not having all the skills if something goes wrong to fix them themselves, not being able to afford all those special services when they come in to do it, to know that you could be sharing with people who have different skills and they barter the skills. One person's a great chef and loves to cook. Another person's a great gardener and loves to garden. Another person's a great plumber. That's a wonderful environment. Now, Israel's Netanyahu claims it was Palestinians who convinced Hitler to exterminate the Jews. This is from Alternet. Quote, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not known for his nuance, but his disregard for historical facts themselves took a new turn today, that's yesterday, as he claimed in a speech in Israel that the Nazi leader Adolf Hitler actually did not want to exterminate Jews until a Palestinian religious leader convinced him otherwise. And then it quotes Netanyahu and about his grandfather. Well, this statement is almost too absurd to debunk. But for the record, that particular religious person he was talking about met Hitler only once in November 1941. Although the origins of the Final Solution itself have been hotly debated among historians, we do know that by March of that year, Hitler was openly talking about a need to make sure the, quote, Jewish Bolshevik elite would be killed, as well as, quote, all Jews and card-carrying communists in the lands that Germany was taking from the Soviet Union. This order was carried out by Heinrich Himmler, who delivered these instructions to his group. So, that's being completely debunked today, Netanyahu. But a lot of Americans simply don't know the truth about the origins of the Jewish state, the Palestinian state that was there before. And today what we have is we have a quagmire. We have people who should be living cooperatively in peace with each other. Both the Palestinian and Jewish people deserve to live a quality of life without fear, that what they treasure, what they value, their religious views, their families, their cultural identities, can be lived each day without the consequences of someone killing them, injuring them, terrorist attacks. But on both sides, it is my belief, there are a limited number of people in positions of power who don't want that. They don't want cooperation. They don't want conciliation. They don't want two individual states. And as a result, there is conflict. But the history that we are being presented in the United States is not accurate. Here are some principally Jewish historians and scholars telling you the history that the mainstream media has not yet found the courage to tell you.
The number one myth that Westerners have about this conflict is that Arabs and Jews have been fighting for thousands of years and they're going to continue to fight.
This is really quite bizarre because all it takes is a little bit of reading of history to find out that this just isn't true. There is no congenital historical enmity between the Arabs and the Jews. The Jews flourished in the Arab world at a time when they were being persecuted throughout all of Europe.
At the end of the 19th century, because of anti-Semitism in Europe, European Jews began to try and figure out a solution to the Jewish problem. A very small minority adhered to Zionism, the idea that the only place in which they could be safe is within a Jewish state.
Zionist Jews actually had a design on the land of Palestine, the idea of creating a homeland for Jews in the land of Palestine. And this is really the beginning of the conflict.
The mainstream Israeli Jewish society believed, because that's the way they had been educated, that Palestine was empty, had been empty when the Jewish settlers came there.
Who paid the price when they settled there? Is it really true that Israel was a land without a people for a people without a land?
Palestine was not empty. It was a land populated by Arabs who had a high level of culture, high level of education.
With farms and markets and towns and villages and roads and commerce and lots of interaction with the rest of the world.
The population was overwhelmingly Arab.
Jewish immigration increased under British rule following World War I, when Britain implemented the Balfour Declaration, promising a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This measure conflicted with Britain's previous promise of self-rule for Arab inhabitants throughout the region.
Britain was basically extremely supportive of the Zionist movement. It helped to establish all of the structures of a state. At the same time, the Arabs of Palestine were denied the right of self-determination.
The Palestinians saw a European power decide the future of a non-European territory in flat disregard of both their presence and wishes. In the 1920s, as land was being stripped away from local residents, the first clashes between Palestinians and Jews began and would continue on for years to come. Until the early 1930s, the Jewish population of Palestine remained under 17%. Hitler's rise to power in Germany completely changed that. In just 5 years, 174,000 Jews flooded into Palestine, doubling their population. As the world attempted to make amends for the horrors of Nazi genocidal policies, efforts to make Palestine a Jewish homeland increased.
The Palestinians, they were not the Nazis. They were not responsible for the Holocaust. But they were the ones who paid the price.
In 1947, with the conflict spiraling out of control, Britain decided to turn the problem of Palestine over to the United Nations. The UN, under pressure, proposed to divide the land into two states, an Arab state and a Jewish state. Arabs were to be given 43% of the land, despite the fact that they made up more than two-thirds of the population and owned over 92% of the land. Jews were to be given 56%, although they comprised only one-third of the population and owned less than 8% of the total area.
Nevertheless, they were given not only most of the land, they were given the most fertile land.
Zionist leaders took advantage of their superior military preparation and immediately began occupying major Arab cities in Palestine.
I was among the people that conquered Akko. When we were walking around, we entered the flat. There was a pair of shoes of a small child, maybe 2 years old. They didn't have time to put on the shoes, so they left the shoes and they ran away. They left everything.
We found out that there was a systematic expulsion of Palestinians, and there was, as I said, there was an ethnic cleansing operation taking place.
The most infamous campaign was the massacre at the village of Deir Yassin, where over 100 men, women, and children were systematically murdered. The ruthlessness of the attack on Deir Yassin drove fear and panic into the Palestinian population and led to the flight of unarmed civilians from their homes all over the country.
As a result, maybe 300 or so thousand Palestinians had already been expelled before the first Arab soldier entered Palestine.
Some of the neighboring Arab armies finally intervened after May 15, 1948, when Israel officially announced its statehood.
Although there was a lot of war rhetoric on the Arab side, very few soldiers, Arab soldiers, were sent into the battlefield. And actually, for most parts of the war, there was a superiority on the side of the Israeli army.
The Israeli army cleansed much of the territory and took over a large part of the designated Palestinian state.
The new state of Israel encompassed 78% of the total land of Palestine. The West Bank came under Jordanian control and the Gaza Strip under Egyptian dominion. Although a truce was declared between Israel and the Arab states, true peace remained elusive, as over 700,000 Palestinian refugees languished in nearby camps, often in sight of homes to which they still held the deeds and a deep desire to return.
Most of the deserted and evicted Palestinian villages were erased from upon the earth and were either turned into Jewish settlements or into a fertile land.
Of the 500 Palestinian villages in what became Israel in 1948, 400 were destroyed.
These efforts to destroy the possibility of their returning home were countered by the United Nations. which continues to affirm their human right enshrined in international law and morality to return.
A Palestinian who had lost her land or lost his land as the result of the creation of Israel in 1948 cannot come back even for a visit. I can go back to Israel as if I were returning and claim immediate citizenship, having no historic tie, speaking no Hebrew, knowing no one in the country, having no family who ever was there. All that one needs is...
That's one perspective. That's one history of Israel and Palestine. Now, concerning the occupation, I think this short piece is enlightening.
When it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it feels like it's always the same story.
Israel launching an airstrike.
A Palestinian teenager was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers.
A settler couple were driving in the north of the West Bank when they were shot dead.
When a Palestinian or Israeli is killed, it's a tragedy for their family and community. But there's an important part of that story that's usually missing, the occupation. Israel has maintained a military occupation of Palestinian territory since 1967. That's meant Israel has taken over Palestinian lands and built settlements on them for its population in violation of international law. Israel also heavily restricts the movement of Palestinians and controls their economy and even water and electricity. Palestinians living under Israeli occupation don't get a vote or a say in the system that dominates their lives. But here's the bottom line. Violence is an inevitable result of occupation. The killings, the clashes, the stabbings, the home demolitions, the checkpoints, the night raids, the rockets, none of these things happen in a vacuum. Israel has displaced Palestinians from their land, demolished their homes, and kept them in refugee camps. Whether Palestinians protest violently or not, Israel frequently responds with military force. That's what an occupation is. So, can the violence in the occupied Palestinian territories end without an end to the occupation?
Context. All about context. Separately, from the New York Times, from Denise Grady, quote, one of the most respected and influential groups in the continuing breast cancer screening debate said on Tuesday that women should begin mammograms later and have less frequently than it had long advocated. The American Cancer Society, which has for years taken the most aggressive approach to screening, issued new guidelines recommending that women with an average risk of breast cancer start having mammograms at 45 and continue once a year until 54, then every other year for as long as they are healthy and likely to live another 10 years. Okay, well, I can remember when the American Cancer Society was advocating women, even teenagers, getting mammograms. I have been debating on this issue for a long time. It's not new. I don't believe that any mammogram is justified at this point. I believe that it causes cancer. I believe the science is there and has been shown that it causes cancer. And more women will die because of the breast cancer coming from the mammogram than will be saved from a breast cancer detected because of the mammogram. Thermography, which is measures the heat differentiation in the body between the cancer cell, which is hotter and will show up differently. And in fact, it will show up before a mammogram will. So you get an earlier detection. That's what should have been advocated. And there's no radiation, hence there's no downside. Now here's the question. They now acknowledge they were wrong. Well, why then shouldn't those people who had mammograms, who later developed breast cancer, why shouldn't they be given a call and apologize to them for the unscientific advice given to them? And finally, before we take a... No, you know, I'm going to hold this part for... It's a little longer piece on what's happening with the Silicon Valley bubble from someone who is out there and spent the last 15 years there. We have our guest coming up in 5 minutes. What we're going to do right now is something fun. I love introducing new products, especially products that are unique that we need. This is the new Gary Knoll water filtration system, absolutely new, with a metal gone filter. That's what it's called. This filtration unit contains two filters. First, the ultra-ceramic filter is designed to remove parasites, bacteria, chlorine, lead, particulates, and chemicals. In addition, the ceramic filter will improve taste and odor of the source water. The pure metagon filter is designed to remove fluoride, heavy metals, chloramine, and pharmaceutical drugs. The ceramic filter is uniquely cleanable to remove sediment and restore flow. Elemental silver is incorporated into the ceramic to prevent the regrowth of microorganisms trapped in the filter. And the combination of these two filters will achieve maximum reduction of a wide range of contaminants found in source water, your tap water. Now, the housing is made from food-grade, non-leachable polypropylene. Undercounter unit is supplied with two housings mounted to bracket. We have an above counter and a below counter. So what is the measurement on contaminant? Let's say parasites and bacteria. They're really bad in water. Reduction by 99.99%. Turbidity, 99%. Lead, 99%. Chlorine at 2 parts per million, 99%. Chloramine, 99%. THMs and HAAs, 98%. VOCs, 95%. Particulates at 0.5 microns, 99.99%. Fluoride, 85%. Aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, iron, nickel, 80%. And so it goes. So what do we have? We have what I believe is the most powerful, important, and best dynamic of any water filter for home use in the world. If you know of a better filter that has been laboratory tested to clean your water better, then buy it. I know what's out there. I haven't seen it. And it has the highest percentage reduction of fluoride of any filter on the market. The new Pure Metalgon filter also is rated for 99% chloramine reduction, the highest on the market. It is the best been tested by the ANSI and the NSF standard 42 and 53 for chloramine and lead reduction at 99%. You can clean the filter so you restore the flow. And to get rid of 99.99% of parasites and bacteria, show me another filter that does that. So, and your old filter casing, you can actually use that with the new filters. The filters can be retrofitted into Gary Nall's larger white housing filter. So here's the deal. We have a limited supply of only about 30 of these right now. They're just in today. Now, the website shows $449. I'm offering $379. Interesting, because I was at an expo recently that I won't mention that had a $5,000 filter and doesn't compare in what it does to this one. And the above table and below above counter and below counter, both $449, now yours for $379. But you can also get the new ultra-ceramic filter, and it can fit into all new Gary Nall countertop and under counter models. And it's normally $119, and it's yours for $99. And so that's it. So you're getting phenomenal deals. Let me give you a number. Write this down, because I only have 25, and it takes about 3 months to make them again. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. If you want a filter, a water filter, the best water filter I know of in the world, this is it. All right? This is it. But you don't have to take my word for it. Let's say hello to Dr. Roy Spicer. He is a 35-year expert in water sciences. He was he has a BS degree in biology, has a PhD, Rutgers University. He was magna cum laude in biochemistry from Fairleigh Dickinson University. And he has a PhD in biochemistry from Rutgers University. And he has spent 35 years studying water chemistry. Nice to have you with us today, Roy.
Nice to be on with you, Gary.
Roy, you were given the task of seeing how does the Gary Knoll new water filter compare with any and all other water filters in the United States, no matter what their price, even if they're $5,000. Tell us what now. And by the way, have we had any conversation before going on the air right now?
Not at all, Gary.
Okay, so I'm going to hear what you have to say at the same time the audience is. This is live radio. We have not rehearsed anything. You tell me what the studies show. You tell me why this, if you feel, based upon your research, this is the best water filter in the United States.
Well, I have all the laboratory data in front of me, and what stands out the most are two things. First, fluoride reduction. The newer type of fluoride is called fluorosilicic acid. It's a lot more toxic than the old type of fluoride, and the filters that are used on the market don't even remove it 20 to 30% at most. The new metal gun filter that you have with the laboratory tests were done at the Water Quality Association laboratories reduced it 85% at high levels, which is remarkable. Now, this is the new fluorosilicic acid that was used in a city municipal water. So right out of the gate, you have a filter that can remove one of the most toxic substances that is neurotoxic, causes brain damage, has been linked to lowered IQ and even dementia and Alzheimer's. So that's a key contaminant you want to remove. And the metal gun filter is exceptional at removing it. The second contaminant, which you mentioned, was chloramine. That's a newer disinfection chemical that's being used now by many, many municipal treatment companies. About 30 to 40% of the municipal supplies use chloramine, which is a combination of chlorine and ammonia. All the carbon blocks on the market that are standard carbon blocks do not remove the ammonia part and the byproducts of chloramine. Your testing on this filter at Pace Laboratories, which was tested to NSF ANSI standards, reduced chloramine 99% at 3 parts per million, which is a very high level of chloramine. I'm not aware of any other filter that can do both fluoride and chloramine in the same filter. That's a remarkable development. It's a new technology that I have not seen before. And then if you go down the list of contaminants that are removed, as you mentioned, the byproducts of chlorine and chloramine, that's the trihalomethanes, those are some of the most significant chemicals that will contribute to cancer. They're carcinogens. So when you look at the overview of the combination of filters you have, plus the removal of bacteria and parasites at a high level, there's nothing on the market that I'm aware of that can even come close. As you mentioned, it's far superior to any combination of filters. And it's a big advantage because you can retrofit them to any of your existing filter housings. So if somebody doesn't have a filter system, they should definitely get one. If they have an existing Gary Knoll system, they should retrofit these filters into them. And just as a sidebar, that $5,000 unit is an alkaline machine which creates hydroxide-free radicals, very unhealthy, and it doesn't remove any of these contaminants.
I told the man that when I saw him in his booth, but he was giving me his little unscientific sales pitch, and I was thinking, my goodness, for a small amount of money, people then don't have to be concerned about what comes out of their tap, because if people only knew how many medicines, tranquilizers, chemotherapy agent, AIDS drugs, and come out into the water, and you drink that, and we now know that there's biological activity of parts per billion. It's very dangerous. Thank you, Roy.
Yeah, these are all unregulated. Yes, you're right, Gary. These are unregulated contaminants. They're not even reported in the water reports, and I'm seeing that more and more with these new studies. So the filter you have, the metal gun, will remove high levels of those pharmaceuticals. That was some of the initial data that was done on the filter also. So it's pretty impressive.
Well, if anyone knows of a better, higher quality water filter, buy it. But if not, then Metal Gone, the Gary Knoll water filter, it's the newest advance, it's the newest model, it's just out today, and these are all put together, and we only have 25. Call, and you're getting them on sale, call 877-627 5065, 877-627-5065. If you already have a Gary Knoll water filter, you can call and get just the filters because they can fit into those old housings. That was something that was considered in the redesign. What if someone just bought a filter, you know, last year? Okay, fine. The housing stays, but the filter is what really does the job. And that we can easily, simply have it refitted, and it's inexpensive. So you can call and get the replacement filters. So that's it. I care about the water goes in my body. If 72% of your body is water, why not have the healthiest water possible, the cleanest water possible? And that is why this invention is so important. The Gary Noll Water Filter, brand new today, 877-627-5065. We're going to go to our guest in a moment. Please stay with us. Back in 20 seconds. I'd like to say hello to Stuart Wexler, W-E-X-L-A-R, in San Francisco. He's regarded as one of the nation's top researchers and investigators into domestic terrorism in America and radical religious militant activities. His groundbreaking research on these subjects and historical terrorism crimes involving the unsolved murder of Martin Luther King has been featured on NBC, USA Today, Boston Globe, and many other media. He was also a presenter at numerous JFK assassination conventions. He holds a master's degree in political science from Rutgers University and is continuing in its graduate program. He's a recipient of the James Madison Teachers Fellowship. He's authored 3 books on religious terrorism and radical warfare in the U.S. His latest is America's Secret Jihad, The Hidden History of Religious Terrorism in the United States. Nice to have you with us today, Stuart.
Hi, thank you for having me on, Gary.
Stuart, I'd like to begin with a surprising statistic that very few listeners will be familiar with. According to an FBI report, between 1980 and 2005, 90% of all terrorist threats, attacks, and deaths have been due to domestic religious extremism and not by Muslim terrorists or jihad terrorist organizations. And more surprisingly, during that same period, there were more Jewish acts of terrorism in the United States than there were Muslim, 7% versus 6%. And since 9/11, over 300 Americans have been killed due to religious political violence, and only 33 of those can be clearly associated with Muslim terrorists. And one of the more violent and threatening of these white supremacists and religious fundamentalist groups is known as Christian Identity. It's a militant religious organization. I'd never heard about them until your research, and unfortunately, we're not being told this by any mainstream media source. In fact, networks like Fox and the right-wing talk shows like Beck and Limbaugh and Sarah Palin and fundamentalist preachers fuel, in my opinion, personal opinion, they fuel racial and religious hatred among people who are most susceptible to embrace a right-wing Christian extremist worldview, even if it's not their intent to do so. It's been documented that terrorists such as Charles Wilson, who threatened to murder Senator Patty Murphy, and Byron Williams and Jim Atkinson, who killed 2 people at a liberal Unitarian church, and James Van Braun, who killed a security guard at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and Greg Gustee, who had threatened Nancy Pelosi, were all inspired by Fox News and Glenn Beck. And there are even more recent cases, such as the Charleston, South Carolina shooting. Moreover, as you've documented, there's a long history of Christian terrorist extremism in the United States, such as the early Jewish synagogue bombings that took place in the 1950s. So please begin by presenting the lay of the land of specifically right-wing Christian terrorism in the United States, with an emphasis upon those who continue to be active today.
So The theme of my book, the major theme, is that Christian identity terrorism, which is, as you highlighted in your discussion there, people don't pay near enough attention to it now, that it actually extends back multiple decades, 5-6 decades, and that some of the most famous crimes in American history are, in fact, and I detail them almost crime by crime in my book, have strong influences, were inspired by, or actually perpetrated by Christian identity terrorists. And what's alarming is, because we've ignored that history for decades, or, you know, diminished the influence of it, this ideology has become so pervasive that it infiltrates groups and even other kinds of offshoot religions, they don't even realize the influence of what Christian identity is. And what it is, it's as much of a perversion of Christianity as militant Salafi jihadism is a perversion of Islam. And I think part of the irony of researching religious extremism is you realize that you can find it in every religion. And part of why I bring this out or I want to call attention is to get us to discuss where it comes in its perverted forms in every single religion. So, and again, just to name some of the crimes I cover in my book, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the Mississippi burning murders, the Atlanta child murders, the Oklahoma City bombing, we're not talking minor events, although some of those unfortunately happen as well. We're talking significant events.
My big question is why neither the government nor the media are discussing the radical elements of Christianity that pose such a serious threat on religious freedom in this country. Instead, we actually run these people as presidential candidates, although people like Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann and Lindsey Graham and others are, I have no proof that they're associated, and I would not imagine they would be associated with any of the extremist Christian militant groups. They nevertheless could be sharing a similar Christian apocalyptic ideology with some of these organizations, which then could be used out of context. And they should be called out publicly on this matter. It should be debated. Your thoughts on how, on the one hand, law enforcement may go after Christian Identity or the KKK and other extremist groups, and rightly so, yet at the same time ignore those who have a large public presence and yet preach a kind of Christian Sharia that would contribute to the same kind of violence that ISIS or Saudi Arabia is engaged in.
Well, I mean, first off, as extreme as you may find someone like Sarah Palin to be, and the idea of the apocalyptic nature of the religion, there definitely needs to be more of a discussion on how mainstream apocalyptic ideas influence things like Middle Eastern policy. And I tell people all the time, the book series Left Behind, which is an apocalyptic Christian book, and it's a conventional one, is one of the most highest-selling series in the history of the country and probably the world. But what's alarming is the apocalyptic nature of the people who I discuss, they have a very dark racial and anti-Semitic element to their apocalypse. Their apocalypse is basically a race war. And so what they try and do is instigate a cycle of violence between whites and blacks and Jews and all different kinds of groups try and unite a race war. That's what Dylann Roof in South Carolina was. He writes, I wanted to start a race war. And that race war ideology has had a very unfortunate impact on the United States for 50 years. And law enforcement in some quarters pays attention to it. The other danger is that some of the more fundamentalist Christians thinks that every time a study comes out and says exactly what you said at the beginning of the show, that there are Christian-oriented groups, however much they might pervert it, who are very dangerous. They see it as a political stunt to go after Christians, and maybe that's because they don't get how the religion can be perverted. But that's where I think the danger, the connection comes, is instead of just reflexively saying this study, it's meant to go after the right wing, consider the possibility that these people are legitimately dangerous.
Okay. How is our domestic law enforcement and intelligence agencies handling domestic terrorist groups? And if domestic terrorists are a far greater threat and they are right here on American ground, we would expect that far more could be done to lessen the growing numbers of people being killed by non-Muslim religious extremists. So somewhere in this equation, our intelligence and law enforcement is failing dramatically. Also, I don't doubt that many employees in law enforcement embrace and believe in extreme Christian ideology. That's my belief. I'm merely projecting that. What are your thoughts?
Well, in a couple of things here. The major way that these groups have been combated over time has been through human intelligence, use of informants. And that runs the problem where you get into these conflicts of interest where some of these informants actually become entangled in the actual crimes. And that's almost a sub-theme of the book. It happens to be effective, but the groups themselves adjust their strategies accordingly. And one of the things they're doing is increasingly trying to recruit people in the military, people in law enforcement agencies. So I don't know if there's people who are sympathetic necessarily to the ideology of these groups, but there are people who are going out and trying to find people and recruit people and convert people to do so.
All right. My final question is, the Department of Justice continues to withhold information relating to criminal civil rights cases that are on hold because new evidence is pending in order to move cases forward. I suspect that many of these cases may be related to religious factions that the government doesn't want information released about for various reasons. Am I being, let's say, is that too extreme a concept?
Well, I think 90%, I would agree with 90% of what you say. There is, unfortunately, too much secrecy, opacity on issues related to these civil rights cold cases, some going back 50, 60 years. Some of it may be a little bit darker in terms of why the motives are, but I suspect the motives are reflexive protection of sources and methods, and then a lot of protection of a lot of CYA. Because if your informants became entangled in these crimes, then you look incredibly bad that you let the crime happen or that you hired said person as an informant. And that's actually a major goal of mine, is to try and get those files released so that we can shed some light on this issue.
Well, then I have a follow-up, because this, you've led me into a little different thought. If the Bush and Obama White Houses declare that the U.S. is engaged in a war on terrorism, which they have, and neither administration had any reservations about sending drones to destroy any and all suspected Muslim terrorist sites, isn't it a bit hypocritical that this so-called war only targets Muslims and ignores other non-Muslim terrorist groups, even against the warnings of our own law enforcement intelligence agencies that have shown repeatedly that homegrown non-Muslim terrorism is a greater threat?
I think not only hypocritical, it's dangerous. And when it becomes an issue about making it about Islam, when it's really about a perversion of Islam, you spend your resources on things that you don't need to spend them on. So we could be taking resources away from sort of a too wide open approach to Muslim terrorism and directing it against some of these other extremist domestic groups, and we'd probably be safer for it.
Okay, I appreciate your insight, Stuart. Thank you very much for the scholarship and work you've done on this. Stuart Wexler, the book is America's Secret Jihad, The Hidden History of Religious Terrorism in the United States. I'm Gary Knoll.
Thank you very much.
We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.